Many of you are aware that President Obama joins a select group of people tomorrow with names such as Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Roosevelt. It hasn't been all that many times when American presidents have had the opportunity for a second inaugural address. In fact, only 16 of Obama's 43 predecessors have given more than one inaugural speech. Interestingly, five of our first seven presidents were reelected. And then, of course, there's Franklin Delano Roosevelt with four. But that's not going to ever happen again for any other American president. People have said that the second inaugural address tends not to be as memorable as the first because all the excitement is over. And maybe that's why for Washington's second inaugural, it was very brief. And we don't quite know what President Obama is going to be talking about tomorrow. There is one second inaugural address that stands out from the rest, and I'll comment on that in just a couple of minutes. So George Washington's second inaugural, I said, was brief. Yeah, 135 words. Thomas Jefferson used his second inaugural to complain about how the press was treating him, and they were pretty vicious, actually. I mean, we think that President Obama has been treated poorly, and I think he has, with more than a tinge of racism. But Thomas Jefferson, they were downright vicious. In his second inaugural, 1937, FDR did use the memorable phrase that he saw one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, and ill-nourished. And then, of course, there was Richard Nixon's 1973 remark that he vowed to, quote, make these next 4 years the best 4 years in America's history. Well, if you view the fact that he resigned shortly thereafter as among those best 4 years, then, but that's not what he had in mind at the time. I think it's interesting that we are living more and more in a world of Twitters and tweets and texts and emails, and we could argue that writing well, choosing words carefully, is becoming less and less of an art form and maybe even less and less important. In the last election, though, eloquence, choosing the right words at the right time and the right place, was clearly important. If you might have been speaking a little thoughtlessly and uttered a phrase such as, binders full of women, you might have found yourself in a bit of a pickle. Dill. Eloquence. I think President Obama achieved eloquence in a most difficult moment when he spoke to the nation at Newtown, Connecticut, in the wake of a horrific tragedy. I was one of many people grateful that he was our president at that time. So voice quality matters, yes. But the voice quality of many speakers is not terrific. Words matter more. And well-chosen words make a difference. President Obama has to live with the fact that he chose words such as clinging to guns and religion once upon a time. But truthfully, most of us can find words of our own, spoken or written, that we would love to strike from our personal record if we possibly could. And conversely, we also live with important words that we have never spoken, never written down, never shared, and we regret that for the rest of our lives. Those would have been, we sometimes think, among our best words. But sadly, we thought of them too late, and they inhabit only our interior world. Once upon a time, I would say to Vicky, somewhat in jest, mind you, that words are my business, until persistent trouble with words, seeking the right one, not finding it, trying to remember the right word, getting the wrong word, finding the words of other people better than my own, that experience made the entire proposition less than humorous, leading me to recast my business as I'm in the people business, thereby opening up an entirely new series of equally embarrassing moments, bringing me to the present day when I now resolve to say, when pressed, that religion is my business. And here I finally feel secure because so many people have messed that terrain up so memorably and so horribly that I feel that any of my own inferiority is minimal compared to the atrocities that others have committed in that landscape. I do remind myself that concern about something, fascination with something, doesn't necessarily lead or imply mastery of it. We can just look at John Boehner's experience as House Speaker for an example of that. So we can affirm that words change lives, save lives, cost lives, destroy lives, and waste lives. Words build up and tear down. They inspire, confuse, clarify, brighten our days, and haunt our nights. In his book, The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Speech That Inspired a Nation, author Drew Hansen talks about one speech, 299 pages for one speech that really didn't take all that long to share. And I had a copy of that book from the Fort Collins Library System, but I loaned it to Elizabeth Sink because she pleaded with me to loan it to her for her classes in communication at CSU. What did Elizabeth Sink find so interesting about what I had to share from that book? Well, what I shared from that book was that when Martin Luther King arrived in Washington, D.C., to make a speech in front of 250,000 people standing right in front of him, millions listening all over the world, myself included, at 16 years old, he wasn't finished with his speech. He gathered his advisors around him as he struggled to figure out what. What do we look for as a speaker? Well, according to many people, a preacher has to have 3 points. 1, 2, 3, you trot them out. At the end of your sermon, you bring them up again. 1, 2, 3, you go home and you're done. There's also the jewel sermon. That is to say, you have one idea or one concept and you look at it from a whole series of different vantage points and the jewel sparkles in different ways. What Martin Luther King said that he needed for the speech on Washington and any speech was a landing strip. He had to know where he was going to land at the end of his message, and he didn't have one. So with his advisors, he talked back and forth about the right word, had a number of choices, finally said, "Thank you for your suggestions," to his advisors. "Now I'm going to go and have my counsel with the Lord." He finishes his speech at 12 midnight, but not to his satisfaction. At 4 in the morning, he has his final draft. It's typed up and distributed to the press. He wants to keep his address within the bounds of about 5 to 6 minutes. So what we have now is we have two speeches. We have the one that he wrote down because he distributed it to the press, and we have the one that he delivered. So here's what we can tell. Larry and Kathy, here's the prepared speech. It's blank in this column. Here's everything that we love about that speech, everything we remember. He added at the last minute. This column is blank. This is full. This column is blank. That was what was written and prepared. This is full. That's what he added at the last minute. This column is blank up to here. This column is blank. This is what he delivered. It's full. It's full. We have everything that he said at the last moment. Go back to Mississippi, go back to Alabama. I say to you today, my friends, I have a dream. Every part of the I Have a Dream speech was added at that moment, on that occasion, at that time. None of it was written down beforehand. Why? Because King, like the best black preachers, and maybe all preachers, knew how to interact with his congregation and his audience. When they were responding to him, he came forth with what he needed to do, and he found his landing strip on the spot. He had used the I have a dream paradigm before in his speaking, but not like this. Not like this. When you listen to the speech on YouTube or you read it, let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, all added on the spot. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing of the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. This is what King wrote. Let us work and march and love and stand tall together until that day has come when we can join hands and sing, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. The delivered text is one of the great speeches in American history, and it came about from that particular moment, and that's the mark of a brilliant orator, which King was. And his words have changed and shaped our nation. But it takes courage to change your text. And he had that courage. August 28, 1963, he had that relationship. There was a very different speaker in American history. His name was Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln had, from every description, a high-pitched falsetto voice. It doesn't sound pretty, but it carried, because a higher voice can carry, and Lincoln spoke very slowly, which is why people in the days before amplification could hear him. It is said, and I can't attest to it, believe it or not, I was not there, 10,000 people could hear Lincoln speak. At the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Douglas had the better voice of the two, a rather deep baritone. Lincoln was the one who could be heard. Lincoln didn't augment his texts. He read what he had in front of him. He wrote it down very carefully. He wrote very succinctly. Most of his speeches are very short. Gettysburg Address, 2 minutes. Edward Everett Hale speaks before Lincoln, 2 hours. Hale writes to Lincoln the day after, if I could feel that I had accomplished in 2 hours what you did in 2 minutes, I would feel that I had succeeded. Lincoln knew how to write, and he wrote carefully. It's said that he read out every word that he wrote to see how it would sound. He achieves parallel sentences and assonance. That is to say, he likes words that have a power when they work together. 47 years ago, our forefathers brought forth upon this nation, at the end of the first inaugural address, William Seward suggests, I close. Lincoln writes, I am loath to close. He's a brilliant writer, which is why the second inaugural address, in my opinion and the opinion of others, is one of the greatest speeches in American history, but it is very unusual. You might think that we'd be safer looking at the Gettysburg Address. That, after all, is the one that generations of students had to memorize. That's the one that is so powerful. Here are a few of the responses to the Gettysburg Address in the few days after Lincoln spoke. The Chicago Times. The cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances of a man who has to be pointed out to intelligent foreigners as the President of the United States. 36 miles from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the Harrisburg Patriot and Union writes, "We pass over the silly remarks of the President. For the credit of the nation, we are willing that the veil of oblivion shall be dropped over them and that they shall no more be repeated or thought of." The Times of London, "The ceremony was rendered ludicrous by some of the sallies of that poor President Lincoln." Oh, well. March 4, 1865, Lincoln does deliver the second inaugural. There's only one picture that we have of Lincoln speaking. It's the second inaugural. Go online. The photographer was Alexander Gardner. Took a number of photographs of Lincoln, including the one on the front of your order of service. When Lincoln began his term in office, he was 6'4" and 180 pounds. He was a very strong man. When that photo was taken, and you can see the furrows in his face, he had lost 30 pounds in office, and the lines of sorrow were deeply writ all over his face. So there's the one photo, I said, of Lincoln speaking. You see him. He's not wearing a hat. John Wilkes Booth can be seen in the photo. He is standing over and some yards away from Lincoln. He, too, is not wearing a hat. 37 days after the second inaugural address, the Civil War comes to an end, and a few days after that, Lincoln dies. All we have left, no videos, no recordings of his voice, only the words. The second inaugural address is 701 words, the second shortest after Washington's. Four paragraphs, 26 sentences, 505 words of one syllable. It is a profoundly moving address. It's in William Safire's book, Great Speeches in History. Interestingly enough, Safire puts it in the section called Sermons. Why? Because this American president, notoriously unchurched, delivers the most theological of all of our inaugural addresses, because he tries to understand God's role in this horrible civil war. Both parties deprecated war, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union, even by war, while the government claimed no right to do more than restrict the territorial enlargement of it. Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with or even before the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and prayed to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. This is the way Lincoln ends. with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which we may achieve, and to cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. It is one of the greatest speeches. It is certainly the most theological, because the long, complex sentence which I omitted has to do with Lincoln's understanding of God acting in history. The same way that once upon a time, Martin Luther King Jr. excused himself from his roundtable discussion and said, "I'm going to take counsel now with the Lord." Words count, don't they? They matter. What we say, what we left unsaid, what we choose to put in, the way we seek help from others, and the way we finally look to ourselves for the answer. Words stir the heart and the mind. The words that work best, finally, are the words we pull from ourselves in our deepest, most honest moment. They can be a little awkward. They might not sound eloquent, but they reach the listener, and that's our goal. To reach out, not with a hand, but with the voice and with the words that we have, and touch someone else, and maybe change their lives or our lives and the world in which we live. And the best words make the world better, more loving, more caring. Lincoln explained why the second inaugural was not popular, and it wasn't. He said, "It will probably go down among the best things I have ever written, but people do not like to believe that the Almighty's purposes are not their own. And so it will take a while. It will take a while. It always takes a while." But that's why that biblical phrase, which I use often in the fullness of time, is so beautiful and so meaningful. In the fullness of time. Let's join together.